Thanks, Patrick. Thank you for the invitation. So my apologies, this has nothing to do with spin liquid, but since this is subject of topical interest and related to frustrated magnetism, might be appropriate. So I'm going to talk about some unpublished experiments on heat capacity on this material, cobalt niobate, which is turning out to be perhaps the closest thing that we have found so far. Well, not we, but experimentalists have found so far to mimic this favorite toy model that theorists like to consider for the quantum phase transition, transverse Ising model. And as always, the experiments are much more complicated than the model, and many people have been busy trying to find out what the differences are. So our contribution is to do heat capacity to map out the phase diagram. And surprisingly, even though this material has been known for maybe 20 years, maybe longer, since 79, the phase diagram in the interesting part, where you apply the magnetic field perpendicular to the easy axis, had not been done. And so share the data with you. The experiments are all done by Tian Liang, my student, with on crystals grown by Dr. Kupaye from Johns Hopkins, and with help from Bob Carver. So I'll remind you what why this model is interesting. I'll be telling you things that you know very well, much better than I do. Anyway, so this is just to remind you. And then I will spend quite some time discussing the neutron scattering data, or Caldea, which is what piqued our interest. So it seemed to present the closest experimental evidence for all these interesting solutions that have been known for many decades regarding the transverse Ising model. And then I will, in the final part of the talk, I will describe the heat capacity and the spin entropy and show how we attempt to understand the results and what it tells us going forward. And I acknowledge funding from NSF and at Johns Hopkins from the DOE, which is supporting this crystal growth group, which seems to be an essential part of all these kinds of research on novel materials. So the transverse Ising Hamiltonian is easy to write down for an isolated chain, right? So you just have the exchange field along the z-axis, and you apply a magnetic field along the x-axis. And then all of you have seen this phase diagram many, many times. So in the ordered phase, the excitations are domain walls, right? So instead of spin waves, the Ising system only gets up and down. So the excitations are domain walls which move around. And when the transverse field matches the it is equal to J over 2, then you get a quantum critical point. And beyond that, this is usually called the quantum paramagnetic phase. The excitations, now the field dominates, so it's perpendicular to the easy axis, and therefore the eigenvalues are plus or minus up and down, right? And so the excitations is the Zeeman energy to flip an individual spin. So actually, this is a very interesting phase. Well, everything's interesting here. But from what we knew, the only solutions that we could compare with are all in this region. And of course, it doesn't work, and for reasons that are immediately obvious, right? Because now you have many more terms to describe the interchain coupling. So hopefully, as the progresses, I will describe these terms in sequence. The material, I think, was discovered by Wang Klint's group in 79, and immediately became apparent that this was sort of like an Ising chain system. Then many experiments were carried out in the 90s by various groups in Japan, notably the ones led by Ishikawa and Kon. And most of these experiments were with the field parallel to the exchange direction, right, the z-axis along the chain. So the modern interest is of course in the transverse field. So the earlier work is somewhat irrelevant, although of course they mapped out the phase diagram in zero magnetic field. So let me talk about the crystal structure. The basic unit is this Ising chain, right? The zigzag chain, and it consists of edge-shared octahedra with cobalt in the center and oxygen in the vertices. So the cobalt surplus, which means 3d7, right? So in the low spin state, the t2g states are all fully occupied in singlet, and so it's only one remaining electron in the eg state, and that is the 1/2. And there are two chains per unit cell. And okay, so this is the c-axis. The easy magnetization axis, indicated by this arrow, is tilted at roughly 30 degrees to the crystalline axis C in the BC plane. Right, so it's tilted like this. And in the experiments I will describe, we apply a magnetic field along A perpendicular to the BC plane.
What's the spin of cobalt to platinum?
What's the spin of cobalt to platinum? 3 half.
1/2.
3D7.
Spin
state, so
the spin should be
3 half. Maybe J is 1/2. Yeah, effective spin, yeah. 3D6 would be a closed shell, right?
No.
3D6.
No,
low, low spin.
That's high spin. No. That's high spin.
High spin.
That could be spin 3 half. From the moment 1, so J might be 1 half. It might be doubled, but spin 3 half.
Okay, so the effective spin is 1 half.
Effective spin.
Yeah. Actually, I'd like to learn more about that because there's some puzzling aspects of it. Maybe I'll discuss with you later.
Yeah. I think the magnetic moment is too big for it to be spin the same. I mean, that rules it out, just the size of the
moment. No, it spins the half of the moment one, so it's actually J 1/2.
That's fine. The picture he was saying, I don't think it's possible.
That's what it is.
For the 6 spins in the T2G state, it's not possible.
So in experimental, is it exactly 3D7? I mean,
yeah.
Sure, but I mean.
This is a formal valence, yeah.
Yes, formal valence.
To this extent, I don't know. You mean serious LVA type calculations? Direct measurements. Yeah, so high temperature susceptibility measurements are consistent with 1/2.
What's the use of resonant X-ray absorption or something?
That hasn't been done. Yeah, there are not too many experiments on this material. The only ones that I've been able to dig up are these sets. So most of the papers come from these three or four Japanese groups. And then, of course, Cordier's interesting paper from 2010. So there's a lot of experimental opportunity, and, let's see. So borrowing this cartoon from the paper by Leon Balance, this is sort of a cartoon of the system looking down the chain. Right? So the coordination is triangular, and J1 and J2 are very close to each other, and something like 10 times smaller than the J0 along the EZ axis. And the system is it's tending to be anti-ferromagnetic, but obviously highly frustrated. So the system is rather interesting. You have an Ising chain along the Z axis, but then it has this geometric frustration. And it doesn't quite want to be a simple anti-ferromagnet. And so Balance, Cole, and Lee have explored various sublattice of magnetization patterns. But actually, we have tried to search for these states that are proposed by Leon, and the evidence is not in. We don't see them. But I won't be talking about that today, because those are torque measurements that I'm not, we're not ready to discuss yet. Okay, so this is looking down the chains, and the magnetic field is parallel to the A-axis. So the early work, for example, Kobayashi, so they mapped out the phase diagram with the field along the z-axis, the uninteresting direction. So for our purpose, we just want to note that there is a ordering temperature in zero field to initially an incommensurate sort of a spin density wave state. It's incommensurate. Then there's an incommensurate commensurate transition around 1.8, 1.9 Kelvin, then maybe an antiferromagnetic state right down here. So all these complex states will not be relevant for the talk today. So just to remind you, I'm sure all of you are familiar with these papers. Using our data, this is the phase diagram for this material. Right? So using this as sort of a guiding map, the three solutions that will be relevant to this talk are the very early solution by McCoy and Wu that treated the transversizing model in zero magnetic field I think this is for the two-dimensional case. This hairy function solution. And even earlier, so this was in the late 70s, in the 60s earlier, Leib and Schultz and Mattis had applied the Jordan-Wigner transformation to solve the isolated single chain system and in terms of Jordan-Wigner fermions. So that's over here, and the famous CFG solution of Zamolodchikov, showing that at a critical point, you have the E8 exceptional Lie group, and they predicted a series of energies, which Cordier subsequently found to be consistent with his experiments. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, so this I lifted from the paper of Leon. So in addition to the z-axis exchange, right, this is along the z-direction for a single chain, you have the coupling to the other neighboring chains, J1, J2, right, so there are these three terms, and then you have the applied field, right? So and there are other terms, for example, Joe Moore in a recent paper have proposed that along the zigzag in the z direction, along this direction, next nearest neighbor exchange may play an equally important role because they have the same magnitude as J1. But anyway, so this is the Hamiltonian if you want to focus on something from the theoretical point of view. Here I'm reproducing the predictions of Lie call and balance. So now looking down the chain, the system wants to relieve the geometric frustration, and there are many states that are possible. And the authors here indicate that as you march through the critical field, the perpendicular to the chain, the system may jump from one ordered phase to another. Right? So I show this, but we will not have any data to inform this experiment. So there's a ferrimagnet, antiferromagnet, Nael, and Nael 2. Okay, now let me go to the data of Cordier. This is the zero field set of data, right? So they're performing neutron scattering. And in zero field, when you go down to low temperatures at the center of the zone, K equals zero, instead of these spin wave modes that one expects from spin waves, you see these quantized modes. And the towards the black with the boundary of the Brillouin zone, you see that there's a bound state. Everything collapses in one state. Let me just focus on the point here. The sequence of masses or gaps is shown here. And these actually match, as I'll show in the next slide, match the predictions of this array function solution of McCaw and Wu, the solution from the 70s. This is actually very hard to find out, you know, which part of the phase diagram. They never state explicitly that all these figures were for Hx equal to zero. It was something that confused me a lot, but until I found out that this energy was much higher than the subsequent data. They never explicitly stated that, but I think that's what these data refer to. The zero magnetic field spectrum. Okay, so the underlying physics is the following, right? The isolated chain, it costs, once you create the domain walls, right, it costs, there's no difference in energy where you put the domain walls for the isolated chain because the system is happy with the spin up or spin down. However, once you put in interchain coupling, you can express the interchain coupling as a mean field, right, which would be proportional to the magnetization. Then the wrong spin, right, the domain wall that has the wrong spin relative to its neighbors will constitute a cost. So this is like a string, right, in quark physics. And as the domain walls move apart, the cost in energy increases linearly with string. So this is sort of the underlying physics that informs all these phase diagrams. For very low momentum in the continuum limit, it's like a Schrodinger equation with that linear potential here, right? And these eigenfunctions are array functions, and the modes are the roots of this array function. And so McCoy and Wu wrote down the sequence. And this simple calculation actually is confirmed by the Caldea neutron scattering at zero magnetic field. Now, they went further because the Caldea and company, they wanted to not only understand the spectrum here, they also wished to capture the bound states at the zone boundary. So this is their simplified Hamiltonian. They ignored all other excitations except ones involving two domain walls. Right? So the eigenstate, the quantum state is indexed by I and N. I is the position of the first domain wall, and N is the length of the wrong domain, so to speak. So the Hamiltonian is very simple. It's the self-energy of that state plus terms in which either the left domain wall or the right one hops by one. So you either expand the wrong domain by one or you contract it, and you do the same for the left domain wall. And then these terms beta, which will not concern us, are to capture the bound state spectrum at very high energies, high momentum. Okay, so alpha can then be fitted to the spectrum to determine by fitting to the observed spectrum, and beta can be obtained by fitting to the high energy mode. And subsequently, a year later, or shortly after, Rukovich provided an exact solution to this simple Hamiltonian.
The interchain coupling is ferromagnetic or
anti-ferromagnetic?
Anti-ferromagnetic. So it's
frustrated. Highly frustrated, yeah.
So how does this first picture work?
So you mean this picture?
The first one
is simply a continuum limit of this picture. So you say that the system selects out a particular audit state, you know, maybe one of the states listed by Balance and Company. And then the interchain coupling in the mean field spirit is simply replaced by a longitudinal field, right? Right. In other words, I'm adding.
So you have to assume it selects some kind of audit state.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah, all this is occurring in the audit state.
Okay,
yeah.
But you don't know what audit.
Yeah, we don't know what audit state, right?
You don't know what audit state.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that is still an open question. What is that audit state?
Zero field?
Yeah. In zero field, yeah, even in zero field. Is it anti-ferromagnetic?
It's the thing they call anti-ferromagnetic. It's the anti-ferromagnetic state.
But it's highly frustrated.
They're trying to
measure it. Yeah. So you'll be...
up in 1,000.
Yeah. Oops, I'm going forward, sorry. Yeah, but they differ by very little. It's anyway. Yeah, I think it's not known. There are lots of neutron scatter, not lots, but there are several detailed neutron scattering data from the Japanese groups, and at very low temperatures, they do say it's antiferromagnetic in zero field. But as you raise the temperature, it becomes incommensurate.
Yeah, sure, but we're talking about those
are
very low temperatures.
Yeah. Oops. Right, this data, right? So at very low temperature, they claim that the neutron is consistent with an antiferromagnet. But then as you go through up here, it's a spin density wave, possibly related to the phases that you have listed. But there is evidence that it becomes incommensurate, I think. But yeah, so we don't know what the state is, but the mean field is usually captured as a longitudinal field, Hz. All right, okay. So in zero field, yeah, so this is the cartoon from Caldea's paper that captures this string. Picture that I described. So the wrong domain wall, the cost increases linearly, so it's like the quark, anti-quark, like a meson, basically. And the bound states are given by the Airy function, consists of excitation modes of this wrong domain. And they have a certain spectrum which seem to match the experiment very well. The data is sharpest in zero field, so that's where the resolution is best, right? So this seems to be very very satisfactory. Now at high field, which is more interesting, that's when you start to approach the E8, the conformal field theory part that is of great interest to many areas in physics. And unfortunately, the data tends to become more noisy, even though they've gone down to 40 millikelvin. But you can see, I think with a lover's eyes, you can see quantized modes remain, right? So at least they picked up the first two. Then you hit the quantum critical point around 5.45 tesla. In our crystal, it's more like 5.3. This mode softens dramatically, and then you're into the quantum paramagnet regime at higher fields. And that's where the Lieb-Scholz solution is supposedly, the Jordan-Wigner fermions are supposed to be more appropriate, although it's a more complicated Hamiltonian. All right, so this is the digitization of the spectrum, and you can pick up two masses. The ratio of the two masses is predicted by Zamolodchikov, and it's the golden mean when you reach the quantum critical point, right? Of course, when you're away from it, the CFT prediction doesn't hold anymore. And so what Joel Moore did was to show that this remains valid even when you consider the mean field Hz that Patrick mentioned, that is the mean field capture approximation to the interchange coupling. So Joel showed that this is also appropriate. All right, so that more or less wraps up the review.
I mean, you need the AC in order to.
Hey, sorry, sorry, it was the higher order. Sorry, yeah. Good, thanks. The next nearest neighbor coupling. What do you call J
sub? Universal feature of the Ising, when the Ising critical point in the field. Uh-huh. Shouldn't matter in details.
I see. So even this ratio holds when you.
When if you're near the 1D critical point and you perturb, actually, with almost anything, as long as it breaks the Ising symmetry, because that's the most relevant operator, then you should see this ratio.
Yeah. Okay.
You can consider the 3D coupling.
Yeah.
Yeah, interchain coupling. You have to, there's an approximation here, which is if you treat the interchain coupling as a mean field.
Right. But is that valid? Yeah. At the quantum critical point. Maybe we should return to this when I show the heat capacity.
Yeah.
Okay. Other comments regarding? So this is just a review of what. Most of you probably have heard from Paul Diaz himself. So the phase diagram from the heat capacity looks like this. You have the sharp transition to the order phase, right, when the field is applied perpendicular to the EZ axis. And we can only go down to half a Kelvin. We were working hard to lower this, but there are many, many technical challenges once you get into the dilution switch range.
So the 1D critical field is supposed to be what? Because in principle there's a difference.
Well, I mean,
the 1D critical field.
How would you measure it?
Physical critical field?
Yeah, but how would you measure it? You mean experimentally?
Well, so based on Caldea's measurements, they would claim.
But that is a very soft definition, right?
Yeah.
So they would say that when this ratio hits the golden mean, that is the critical field. And I think they meant that to be the 1D critical field,
yes.
Right? But you know, so this is a bit low, right? So that's 5 Tesla. So, but you know, it doesn't preclude 5.4 Tesla, for example. Right. So on the real material, the quantum critical field seems to be around 5.3, 5.4. So the
critical field has to be higher than the 1D.
It has to be higher. Yeah, that's right.
You need more transverse
right,
field to destroy
right.
the orbit.
That's right, yeah. But you know, my point is that experimentally, there's no way to measure the 1D, the real 1D critical field. Right. In view of the fact that this is coming in with zero slope and the error bars are substantial. So I'll mention later, the Zeeman gap is obtained by relying on the Leib-Schultz exact solution. It's not quite satisfactory, but that's the only way we know how to determine that. And we can discuss how accurate that is. With that caveat, the Zeeman gap seems to be linear and terminate at the critical field. So we would call this the ordered phase, and this is the quantum paramagnetic phase. So the data looks like this. Here I'm, so first of all, the phase diagram is shown again here as a guide. Right? So we're taking cuts, horizontal cuts, at fixed temperature, so going through like this. Right? So the heat capacity is measured by an AC method, and we have taken pains to make sure that you know when you have the frequency right, the frequency of choice in the AC heat capacity measurement is critically dependent on the internal diffusion time of the sample, right, and the external time constant to the bath. So you have to make sure that you're at least a factor of 10 between these two time scales or frequency scales. So we always take the full spectrum and then find out where that we are in the optimum window to get the true heat capacity and then once we get that, then we can sweep the field and so on. So these are horizontal cuts, and the sharp maximum, the peak, indicates the 3D ordering. And then you see all kinds of interesting, puzzling features as you go towards the critical point. So the heat capacity shows this rather broad maximum. And so this is indicative of the critical point. And here then we are into the paramagnetic phase.
Do you have plans to go the other one?
Yeah. So, right. Yeah. So we've done cuts in both ways, and right. So these are now cuts that are vertical at fixed field, and are coming down in temperature. So initially at h equals zero, you see this sharp transition at roughly 3 Kelvin. It's a little bit short of that in our sample. In good agreement with the Japanese work, and then you see this little knee that is also consistent with the incommensurate to commensurate transition that they see, right? So in zero field, this temperature region is the incommensurate tendency phase, and then you're back to the commensurate phase. As you increase the field, the transition comes down rapidly, and so you follow it down. And close to the critical point, you see that it wants to come down linearly with the temperature. So this point I'll come back to. Then when you get above the critical field, the behavior completely turns over, right? So all these curves now at high fields pertain to the quantum paramagnetic phase. So sorry for packing all this in one figure. I'm going to pause it. I'm going to look at the phases in turn for the rest of during the rest of the talk. So this is a blow up of the same thing, and to emphasize the crossover from the ordered phase to the paramagnetic phase, going through this interesting T-linear region. It's also interesting to look at this from the using the Sommerfeld function, right? By dividing the previous set of data by T, you kind of emphasize the behavior down here. So the T linear part at the critical field now becomes a temperature independent Sommerfeld function. And as I said, it's obviously very interesting to go down to low temperatures, and we are hard at work on that. Okay, I'm going to break this up into different parts now. All right, so it's very hard to sort of wrap your brain around that because there are several things happening at once. So we need a reference state. And the reference state is the Lieb-Schultz solution for using the Jordan-Wigner transformation. But let me first show you the data that we confront the solution with. So now we are sitting at fields very close to the critical field and then higher, right? So we're moving to higher fields. C over T, the Sommerfeld function versus temperature. So at high fields, it just has this rather simple curve behavior, but then it becomes more and more peaked and looks like sort of diverging rapidly near the critical field. Okay, so to remind you of the Jordan-Wigner solution, what they did was they addressed the original simple Hamiltonian of a single chain in a transverse field. So the spin operators are neither fermionic or bosonic, right? But by using the Jordan-Wigner transformation, they can convert the spin operators to fermionic operators. Then do a Bogoliubov rotation, and you diagonalize this Hamiltonian. Right? So remember, this is for the isolated chain, and surely not capable of describing what the problem at hand. But it does have lots of features that are actually very useful to keep in mind, right? So the solution implies a dispersion given by this square root of a quadratic function in K, where lambda throughout is going to be J divided by 2 times gamma. Gamma is the magnetic field perpendicular to the chain. I'm just borrowing Lee's notation. So where you see big gamma, that's the transverse magnetic field. And then once you know this, then it's straightforward to do to measure the heat capacity, right? It's simply the Fermi-Dirac distribution derivative multiplied by the square of the energy. Okay, so here's what it looks like pictorially, right? So the Jordan-Wigner fermions have a dispersion that looks like this when you are at the critical field. Lambda is 1 at the critical field, and it's gapless. Then when you move away from the critical point, it opens up a gap. And so this should be the gap that I was referring to, right? So it opens up a gap linearly as you go away from the critical field. Now the heat capacity is simply the density of states, let's say, for the non-critical situation, which is one-dimensional, so it has these Van Hoff singularities. You have the Fermi-Dirac derivative, and then E squared for the part of the integrand. So it's basically the integral of these three functions. Right? So as we decrease the temperature, this becomes narrower. If you move your magnetic field towards the critical point, this gap closes. So from here, you can more or less understand how the heat capacity is supposed to behave. So we found that to be very helpful to understand the data that we took. Before we do that, before we do the fit, we have to remove the phonon contribution. But luckily, the phonons are only important at temperatures above 5 or 8 Kelvin. Right? So the groups in Japan, Hanawa et al., showed that if you measure the relative, the non-magnetic relative, based on zinc, you can pull out the phonon background. And they use that to subtract off the phonon contribution to the heat capacity, and we did likewise. And then we find that with very little adjustment, we can more or less match their phonon data to our data. Their data is yellow. So doing that, we can get the what we believe to be the spin only contribution, right? Spin contribution to the Sommerfeld function. To the heat capacity. So this is the spin heat capacity. Since we are at fields above the critical value, we are only interested in the high field pattern. Okay, all right. So on the left are the calculations of the 1D solution to the Sommerfeld function, and on the right is the experiment. And there are similarities that are instructive, although, of course, the Hamiltonian is not supposed to work, right? So let me first walk you through what we thought were the interesting similarities. So at high fields, so high field means that the lambda parameter is small, it has a very obvious Zeeman gap. Then as you approach the critical value, this grows. And then when you are right at critical behavior, critical point, it has this flat Sommerfeld constant, right? But it has this rather large peak in addition. But anyway, so you do have the Sommerfeld constant flat, which is the direct evidence for these fermionic excitations. So you see the same thing in the experiment as well. At high field, you have a very large gap, and then the gap shrinks systematically, but the rise is a lot faster, right? So if I were to match the calculation to this using the same units, you see that you can only get to like 0.3, and 0.3 is down here. So no matter how you Well, there are only two adjustable parameters, right? J and gamma. And J is fixed by the neutron scattering. So you only have gamma and maybe a prefactor. But anyway, you cannot get much above this. So right away you see that this huge divergence simply cannot be accounted for by the 1D solution. This is presumably coming from the interchain coupling. All right, so but nonetheless, we went ahead and did the fit, and the fit is instructive in telling you how this fails, right? So at very high fields, the fit is shown by the dashed line. It gives a pretty good fit throughout, except close to the at low temperatures, right? So there's an excess, if you wish, excess entropy that the 1D solution simply cannot capture. And as you get towards the critical field, it becomes larger and larger. I have displaced all these curves by roughly this amount. And you can see that when you're very close to the critical value, you have a huge discrepancy. These are the points that I would like to draw your attention to. So we allow the two parameters to float for the fit, and we come up with a J that is in rather good agreement with the neutron scattering. Right? So without assuming that we knew the spectrum, we come up with a J of roughly 2 millivolts, which is what Joel Moore also inferred from the data of the idea. So it seems to make some sense, right, in trying to fit the high field value. So at 8 Tesla, it's good, except at low temperatures. And from that, we can pull up the Zeeman gap. So this was the gap that I reported in the phase diagram. Now, as you go towards the critical field, they disagree very strongly. And in all the disagreement is piled up in this strongly fluctuating region. But even so, the experimental curve, again, shows this fermionic behavior. Right? So this is... you cannot see on this plot, but this flat region is evidence for the fermionic excitations despite the interchain coupling. Yeah, it's shown more clearly here, right? So you can see that this part is also flat, except it has a value much, much larger than what the 1D solution would have.
Do you know what the estimated interchain coupling is from neutrons?
It's about 1/10. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I do know that. It's about 0.5 millivolt. J1 and J. I'm pulling it from Joel's paper. Yeah, it's about a quarter of the inch. Well, what did you use in your paper?
We didn't.
Well, you left it. I think that's right. I think it was 0.5 millivolts. Yeah. It seems large. Yeah.
It seems I thought that it's almost negligible dispersion if you look transverse to the chains in the neutron data.
But that K was... wasn't that K parallel to the chain?
Yeah, so when you're seeing these dispersions, that's because you're seeing dispersion parallel to the chain.
Yeah.
If you want to estimate the J...
Yeah, but they...
the chain, you should scan...
They didn't report that data. I don't think it's in their paper. I don't know. Okay, so for the audit phase, we have no guidance whatsoever. So here's an area where theoretical work would be very helpful to the experiment. So let me just show you the... So these are just words, right? So in zero field, the Sommerfeld function peaks and then shows this knee corresponding to the incommensurate transition, but then interestingly, as you go to finite field, the Sommerfeld function, which tends to amplify behaviors at low temperature, shows this increase, this growing trend, which seems to me, it seems like, you know, these curves are trying to catch up with the value at critical value. And we have no idea where this extra contribution to the entropy is coming from. But it would be nice to actually pull this out and compare with some restricted model calculation. Anyway, so that's the... So I've shown these cuts before. So again, you know, to emphasize the point, perhaps that up term, right, that I'm talking about, so these are now cuts in the perpendicular direction. The earlier point was that when you cool down the temperature, the Sommerfeld function starts to increase. Right,
can we go back to the line you were showing before? So, you know, if you imagine, I don't know where the, if you want to think about there being an underlying 1D critical point, mm-hmm. So the 1D critical point, you would have a linear specific.
Right.
But now, because of interchain coupling, that system would actually be ordered at zero temperature. So if I, but imagine that's very weak.
Right.
So then you'd expect to see linear specific heat down to some temperature scale. Eventually it orders, you start crossing over to 3D behavior, so you have to see a peak. Specific has to come up above the linear point and then eventually collapse down again because you enter a gap.
Yeah, so that gives us more. We should take more.
It's unnatural to have, if you want to say it, one, I don't know what other explanation you have, but the linear specific heat would be characteristic of the 1D regime, 1D critical regime.
Right.
If that's the right picture, then it has to come up.
So you are expecting this to come up some ordering temperature. But the system, well, according to the neutron scattering data, this whole area has a gap. And the gap is substantial, actually. Okay, let me go back to Paul Dear's.
Well, the thing is that they're measuring a gap in some particular place in space,
right? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, this might be just a particular cut in K-space. Yeah, so if you look at this energy, it's like 0.3 millivolts, right? So that's 5 Kelvin. So that's pretty large. Yeah. But yeah, in the other scan directions, there might be...
I think that's not cutting through the actual soft mode.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so there is a lot of.
If you say that the transverse exchange is 0.5 millivolts, right?
Right.
It's about that energy, so you can imagine the spectrum changed by about that much as you scan in the transverse directions. A very good estimate for the thermodynamic.
That's a good point, right? So yeah, what I was going to say is that perhaps they are related to this, they're sort of sensing, so this is just a cut, right, at a fixed temperature, but sensing this very large peak centered at the critical point. And we have integrated these curves, right, using this equation to get at the spin entropy at a finite temperature. And they in the audit phase, they seem to converge at high temperature to the log 2 value. Similarly, in the paramagnetic phase, the convergence is to the log 2. But we see this very puzzling overshoot at the critical point, which we're still scratching our heads. It seems to be more entropy if you stick to the Ising model than given by the log 2. But we are checking our calibration to make sure that this value is correct. We think it is, but it bears a checking out. Okay, so let me summarize the points. In the quantum paramagnetic phase, the 1D solution seems to be good for very high fields, but the deviations become pronounced as you walk towards the critical value, right? So it gets indicated by these curves growing very rapidly. And there's a hint of the 1D fermion behavior near the critical field, and that's this curve here. And in the audit phase, we do not have a theory to compare against, except to point out this interesting growth at very low temperatures. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, you said that the old study put parallel field as a sort of boring direction. I agree with. But on the other hand, if you really want to know all the transverse couplings, I mean, couldn't they simply just do neutron scattering in that field and then do the trick of just going into the ordered phase, and then you would get out, you could read off the transverse coupling from the excitation dispersion, and they haven't tried to do that?
You mean Cordier and company?
Well, yeah, if you want to, well, I know maybe it was done 10 years ago. If you want to read off the transverse couplings, you should go in the easiest. But that was never done by...
They have a lot of neutron scattering data, actually. The Japanese groups took a lot of data. I can see they had cuts in the other direction. Yeah, until Leon mentioned that I had a problem.
I think there's a thesis
called
a student
looking at it. Yeah. So you think it's too large, 0.5 millivolts?
I was looking through that thesis just now, and it's on the web. Mm. And I think what number is similar to that, I think 0.2 and 0.4 millivolts.
Okay.
It's pretty big.
But that's the coupling, it's not the dispersion, because it's frustrated. So I mean, if you're talking about the dispersion is going to be much smaller than the actual value of the coupling. And this is where the confusion is coming from.
No, not necessarily. Depends if you look at the excited states, they can disperse a lot.
Yeah, I'm not a bit confused.
Is it possible to do these to lower temperature?
Yeah, we're trying to, yeah. The major technical challenge is that all the time scales become longer at low temperatures. And also, it's sort of a silly problem. You have to align the field very carefully in these experiments. And dilution fridges, this is a big challenge, you know, because you can certainly rotate the sample along one axis. But this is what everyone in the quantum Hall effect business does. Right? But to have two axis rotation is very challenging. So it's a technical challenge.
You're not running into a nuclear shock
either? Probably not.
Might want to help.
Yeah, but that could be an issue too, actually.
Did anyone measure directly G factors? Probably. For example, by ESR?
By ESR? Not to my knowledge.
Could be probably done by dilution with zinc. If there exists material with zinc, then you can put just a few cobalt and see how I think it is.
So I don't know where they got it, but they quote some G factor, which is pretty large, 3.5. That's the Ising.
Realize it, thank you. Is this a what is it?
Good question.
No, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I read this real time.
So at which length scales can you modify the applied magnetic field? Could you think of even some random field phase that you could picture? So at which
magnetic field.
Could you simulate some random magnetic field imposed on that zinc chain?
Experimentally?
Yeah.
By putting in impurities?
No, so for example, if there were some type of, I'm not sure, but for example, in certain optical systems, they use the spectral disorder, mm-hmm. which is quite convenient, not just to get like some sort of, you know, geometric disorder, but also some field, some first
some
base.
Field from yes. Filling the not from the person. But what did you have in mind?
No, I just think that the random field phase is also very interesting in such a model. So if one could sort of, you know, get sufficient strong variations of the direction of the magnetic field as a function of distance imposed on that chain, if this were possible experimentally, I mean, you could also see how the degree of the disordered field can actually also drive interesting phases in that system. So. But I have no idea how you can typically vary an applied magnetic field in experiment spatially, you know, how fine you can choose the orientation of the spatial grid sort of a magnetic field.
Curiosity between labs or something?
Well, I'm a bit confused about this whole thing. I mean, you're not really asking about Eisenmüller and transverse field. What you're really asking is to understand the crossover between 1 plus 1 dimension to 3 plus 1.
No,
it's not all the phases. It's not a one-dimensional problem anymore. So.
Right.
So what you're really asking us is to provide a dimensional crossover.
Yeah. But you know, it seems that you have to confront all these issues when you do an experiment on the radio machine. So you have to then try to infer from such measurements what are the most important corrections.
Is the question that if in the chain coupling is so important, why does Coderre see this very nice agreement is always
sure.
Is that the question you
I think Joel Moore in his paper did address some of it also.
They treated interchain coupling as something else, so it doesn't change. It was like pretty much what you feel.
Yeah. There is a question, how M of H look like?
So we have a lot of the torque magnetometry data.
How does it look like?
M of H in, with the field in the chain direction?
Right, in what direction?
Yeah, I didn't bring the data, but I've forgotten the shape of the data, but I think I can sketch it up.
As people measure the some of acuity in this, you're able to see this quantum clip.
Yeah, I think a group in China has. They don't see anything very striking as you go through the quantum critical form.
They see the linear
quantum
of
the
just more comment than a question.
Yeah.
But it's a bit strange if you see this key linear specification, you'd like just perhaps attribute it to 1D.
Right.
You would have thought that the ordering would happen at temperatures below the 1D physics. And whereas if you actually look at your data, the field that you claim to be the critical field, there's a peak and then C over T is constant. There, right?
Yeah. We think that this is the ordinary temperature.
Sure.
Right.
It's very hard to argue with that.
So when you say that 1D appears below the ordering temperature.
Well, you would have thought, if you certainly think of weakly coupled chains, that you would have. Same something as far as the temperature.
But this is the experiment.
This center be exceeding log 2, what could it be?
Well, in my mind...
What other degrees of freedom?
What
other degrees of freedom could exist? Entropy more than log 2.
Well, log 2 assumes that you only have spin up and spin down rigorously.
Yeah,
but once you get close to the point, critical point, that restriction may break down. And so the fluctuations could be in other... could be...
have to be our crystal field.
If it's spin mark out, then you don't have them include the log 2. Some other beliefs.
Yeah, we don't.
And how much of your entropy is? I mean, you to do that calculation, you assume some form for an entropy for CFRT below your measurement, on a measurement temperature. If you have the thing dove down.
So even if this came down, it would still exceed.
You still overshoot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so if this holding is zero, then it would come close to log 2. But if, you know, anything that what we did was put this in a platform, but that's a maximum approximation. So we agree we have to take lower temperature data to stake a claim. This is that log 2 excess is a suggestion as well. The phonons made from the phonons. No, the phonons that you get below 5 Kelvin are something like 1% of the
special soft nickels are more.
Yeah, so if you look at the phonons. So. Yeah, right. So if I can get up to 5 Kelvin.
So that's your mag material. But maybe because it couples to the magnetism.
Yeah. Okay. So that's something that's beyond.
Actually, I have a question exactly to that point. Why are you so sure that this is 1%? I mean, the phonon coupling. You rely on a model calculation. Where do you extract this from?
No. This is on a non-magnetic cousin.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a crude subtraction, but you know this is the way experimentalists approach the problem. How can you subtract off the phonon contribution? But you think that it could change it by, even if I increase it by a factor of 3 or 4, right, it would still make a minimal contribution to the area. Right? And that's already a very large stiffening of the phonons. Yeah, it's a puzzle. I don't know.